The sermon this morning is drawn from both the gospel reading and also from a few verses of the epistle reading, specifically verse 12 through 15. Concerning the gospel reading, I have heard several sermons on it in my lifetime. It is a favorite passage of ministers. It generally flows in two ways. One, there is a focus on Christ's exchange with Peter about love. Peter, do you love me more than these fish? Lord, you know I love you. Peter, are you sure you love me? I love you. That gets a lot of focus, especially since the two words for love are so interesting. Jesus, the first few times, asked him, do you agape me, as we heard about last week. And Peter always responds with, Lord, you know that I have brotherly affection for you. Meaning that Peter was saying yes, but not quite. And then at the end, Jesus says, Peter, do you even have brotherly affection for me? And Peter says, yes, Lord, this is where I've risen to. It either is that, or they will focus upon the restoration of Peter, and it tends to be a wonderful three-point sermon. And ministers love three-point sermons. You can count them off. At the end of the third point, you're done. The three points are, they focus on the great sin that Peter has committed, that he should have to be restored. And indeed, it is a great sin to deny the Lord, and he denied him three times, and so he is restored three times. The second point is that restoration comes with a purpose. Jesus does not just restore Peter, but gives him a ministry. Feed my lambs, feed my sheep, that sort of thing. And then finally, that service that he is restored to has to do with God's elect. It is God's lambs, God's sheep. Peter, you're being restored, but you're being restored to be my servant. Care for my people. It's a great sermon. It really is. It's inspiring. It's excellent as far as it goes. But there is more that Christ says right afterwards. And to be honest, as I considered preparing for this sermon, I don't remember any minister I've ever heard going beyond that passage into what Christ next says, but there's no break at all. If you just read the passage, verse 18 through 22 flows right out of it. And the sermon ends before that. But then those verses aren't quite so inspirational in some ways. Certainly not from any sort of worldly point of view. Those verses, though they are somewhat poetic, are very clear that Peter is going to become a prisoner. Peter is going to be put to death. Not tomorrow, not next week, but Peter is a doomed man. Jesus looks him in the eye and says, you are going to, in all the world, seem one day like a true and absolute loser in this life. The world will not consider you a winner. You are going to be victimized, and you are going to die. It happens exactly as Jesus predicted. We read this of the martyrdom of Peter. This is from A.J. Mason, and he's quoting Ambrose. Outside Rome, on the Appian Way, stands a little chapel known as Domine Quo Vadis. For those of you who know Latin, you can correct me. It means, Lord, whither goest thou? Bishop Lightfoot, among others, is inclined to believe the story that the Christians at Rome came to Peter at the start of the persecution and begged him to flee from the city. Peter gave in to their pleas. When Peter reached the place where the chapel stands, Jesus Christ met him in the middle of a dark night. The apostle asked his Lord, as he had done before, what do you want me to do? The Lord answered him, I go to Rome to be crucified again. Peter was quick to understand the meaning behind this rebuke. He returned to Rome and told the Christian brethren what he had seen, and then glorified God by his death, as the Lord had foretold that he would, when he said, "And another shall gird thee and carry thee whither thou wouldst not." Fox's Book of Martyrs describes it this way. Having been 9 months in prison, Peter was brought from thence for execution, when, after being severely scourged, he was crucified with his head downwards, which position, however, was at his own request. Not a glorious way to die in the eyes of the world. Naked, nailed to wood, and left to the mocking of the crowd. But that was probably not the worst part of Peter's martyrdom. This happened before, speaking of his wife, whom history tells us was named Concordia. Peter, before his own death, had the pain of witnessing what must have been worse than death to him. The Apostle Paul tells us that Peter was accompanied by his wife on his missionary travels. She was probably with him still when Peter went to Rome and there preceded him to martyrdom. She may have been one of those women of whom Clement speaks as going through a terrible death for the amusement of the Roman crowds. Peter may have seen his wife taken away to be killed, saying, as he looked on, that he was happy in his heart, quote, because she had been called and was going home. He lifted up his voice, so the ancient story runs, and addressed her in a very encouraging and comforting manner, speaking to her by name. The name had been forgotten, some late legends give it as Concordia, and saying, "Remember the Lord, Concordia," or whatever her name was. Such, says the old narrator, was the marriage of the saints and their disposition at the last to those whom they loved so dearly. It's inspiring to believers, at least to the early church, but to the world, Peter would have looked like a terrible loser. He died horribly, his wife died, horribly. He could not protect her from the authorities. The world would likely shake its head and say, what a horrible way to go, what a terrible end, what an utter loser. But then our Old Testament lesson kind of left us with that taste in our mouth too. Cain and Abel are born, and Cain does not do right, quote unquote. Whatever it is he was not doing right is not important, and so Moses doesn't tell us exactly. But whatever it was, he was displeasing to God, and when he brought an offering before the Lord did not accept it. Abel was pleasing to God, and Abel became the first murder victim of all humanity. The story ends with him in the ground, and we're told later in Hebrews that his blood cried out from the ground to the Lord. We're told it in the same passage. It's significant to the biblical writers. But he's still dead. And Cain is living. God could have extracted eye for eye, tooth for tooth, life for life. God chose to be gracious to Cain. And he leaves him alive, but Abel is dead. That doesn't really seem right in our eyes. But then, there's a lot of things that don't seem right in our eyes, and this kind of theme plays out throughout so much of the Bible. Another passage, like our gospel lesson, is from Isaiah, and it's used almost in the same way as our gospel lesson. I've heard this passage time and time again, but it's usually an ordination or the consecration of church, something like that. It's very famous. I'm sure that you'll recognize it the moment I begin to read. It's effectively the call of Isaiah. In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting on a throne, high and lifted up. The train of his robe filled the temple. Above it stood seraphim. Each one had six wings. With two he covered his face, with two he covered his feet, and with two he flew. And one cried to another and said, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory." The minister would then expound on the glory and wonder of God, and then he would go on to focus on God's forgiveness of sinners. We would read, "And the posts of the door were shaken by the voice of him who cried out, and the house was filled with smoke. So I said, Woe is me, for I am undone, because I am a man of unclean lips, and I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips. For my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts. And one of the seraphim flew to me, having in his hand a live coal, which he had taken with the tongs from the altar. And he touched my mouth with it and said, Behold, this has touched your lips, your iniquity is taken away, and your sin is purged. Then the minister, in fervent delivery, would move into his third point, a three-point sermon again. It would be verse 8. Also I heard the voice of the Lord saying, Whom shall I send, and who will go for us? Then I said, Here am I, send me. The last hymn would then play. Everybody would be whipped up into a frenzy to serve the Lord. It's a good sermon. It's biblical. But it doesn't finish the account, just like the sermon from John doesn't finish the account. Isaiah is a little curious about his call to ministry and what it will entail. And he begins to ask God what it will be like. And as the passage goes on, we hear that God says this to him. And he said, Go and tell this people. Keep on hearing, but do not understand. Keep on seeing, but do not perceive. Make the heart of this people dull and their ears heavy, and shut their eyes, lest they see with their eyes and hear with their ears, and understand with their heart, and return and be healed. I have a wonderful plan for your life, says the Lord God. I have called you into ministry. I am glorious. I have shown you how wonderful I am. I am sending you as a minister to a rebellious church that won't listen to a word you say. In fact, your very ministry is going to be what hardens them. You know, 20 years in, I can really identify with Isaiah. I've had that happen time and time again. But it's not exactly what we tell new ministers at their ordination. We whip them into a frenzy. Here am I, send me, yay! Oh, by the way, God in His providence is sending you to rebellious people that won't listen to you. Well, Isaiah has a very understandable question. We next read, Then I said, Lord, how long? And he answered, Until the cities are laid waste and without inhabitant, the houses are without a man, the land is utterly desolate. The Lord has removed men far away, and the forsaken places are many in the midst of the land. But yet a tenth will be in it, and will return and be for consuming. As a terebinth tree, or as an oak whose stump remains when it is cut down, so the holy seed shall be its stump. Lord, how long will my ministry be so hard and difficult? How long will I be abused and ridiculed and hated? To the point, says God, where the people are completely destroyed, I have wiped them away, there is but a little stump in the land for hope of my promises. The answer is effectively, Isaiah, your entire life. I'm sending you to minister into a place of ridicule, scorn, and hatred. Church history tells us, and apparently the book of Hebrews alludes to, the glorious prophet Isaiah, who gave us so many great prophecies of the Christ, would meet his end being sawn in two. That's not the way I'd like to go if I had my choice. But then I'd rather not go crucified upside down either. I'd rather not be killed by my brother. And yet, that is exactly what all three men encounter. To the eyes of the world, they are losers, one and all. A friend of mine, another congregational minister, who writes curriculum for Zondervan's, once wrote a stereotypical advertisement slash evangelistic add that the modern church could easily put out. Remember the old army motto, be all that you can be? It's what we Christians tend to tell the world when we tell them about our faith. Be all that you can be. God has a wonderful plan for your life. He envisioned in his ad the elders of the church dancing across the field singing, be all that you can be, come join Christ. Because that's how we present God. But it's not really fair. It's not really the truth. There is nowhere in the Bible where God extends his hand and says, come and follow me, I will make you glorious. Come and follow me, I will make men love you. Come and follow me, I will make you popular. I will make you comfortable. I will make you rich. I will make you healthy. The promises aren't there that way. Now, God promises blessings, but the scriptures are absolutely clear that Christ says such uncomfortable things as, woe to you when all men speak well of you. Blessed are you when you are persecuted for my name's sake. It's not scripture, but it is significant. The writer of Ecclesiasticus, who took the Old Testament law and put it to poetry, said this in the second chapter of his non-biblical book. He said, my son, if you aspire to be a servant of the Lord, prepare yourself for testing. The Greek word is trial, for hardship. Set a straight course, be resolute, and do not lose your head in time of disaster, suggesting that it'll probably happen. Hold fast to him, never desert him. If you would end your days in prosperity, bear every hardship that is sent you. Be patient under humiliation, whatever the cost. For gold is assayed by fire, and the Lord proves men in the furnace of humiliation. Trust him, and he will help you. Steer a straight course and set your hope on him. Syriac studied the Old Testament law, and that's what he came up with. He looked into God's righteous law, and he realized, this is not about you, and this is not about you being glorified. This is about God and God being glorified. You are made to glorify God, but he's the one who gets glorified. John the Baptist said, I must decrease, he must increase. And the theme has never, ever changed. But then in our gospel lesson, it was very, very clear. Jesus did not look at Peter and say, this is the death you will die, thereby being glorified. He said, this is the death you will die, whereby you will glorify me. And indeed, the death he would die and the death that he knew was coming was used by God to glorify himself in many, many ways. The death itself, the death of a martyr, that could easily be its own sermon. God works through the suffering of his people. God works through the humiliation of his people. God works through their giving themselves away that they might receive eternal life. But even before that death happened, God was using the assured promise of a humiliating martyrdom's death to work in the life of the Apostle Peter to make him glorifying to God. In our epistle reading, in verse 12, Peter begins to speak about his ministry. Jesus had told him, feed my lambs, feed my sheep, feed my lambs. Well, this letter is very much an outworking of that ministry. He is feeding the sheep of God, And in verse 12, he says, I will not be negligent to that ministry. Rather, I will always keep it going. Why? Because, says Peter, the Lord has assured me my death is coming. In fact, Peter uses a phrase concerning his physical body that is very, very telling. He calls it a tent. It's not a palace. It's not a home worked of brick. It's not going to be there forever. It's a sojourner's tent. You use it as you travel. You wear it out as you travel. It will not be there forever. Peter is saying, God has made me to realize this physical existence of mine is temporary. I am a sojourner. And I am called to work while it is light, because soon darkness is going to come. This body is a tent. I had better be about the business my Father has given me, because He's given it to me, and there's only so much time to work. In the Middle Ages, the Christians would often write a motto in their homes or in their place of study or work. Ecce morte. Again, those of you who know Latin, if I messed it up, my apologies. But the motto was, remember death. Moderns look at them and they say, those are morbid people. Worshipping death is what they're doing. Glorifying death. Not at all. The Christians were saying, God has given us a certain ministry in life, and life will not be long. Let life be 90 years, it's still not long. I have known so many people in their 90s who told me life feels like it was about 3 months long. Soon comes the night where we cannot labor. Remember death, that we may in fact glorify God in life. And Peter says, I know that my body is temporary. In fact, he says, as long as he is in it, as long, he will stir them up and remind them of these things. And in fact, in verse 15, he says, even after I have died, I am going to minister to you in such a way that my ministry lives on beyond my death. I will see that you can remember these things after my decease. There is no more misunderstood part of the Apostles' Creed than the statement that we believe in the communion of saints. It has various interpretations. It certainly starts on earth, altogether. You and I in this church, in this room, we share in the gifts that God has given. We build each other up by the grace of God given to us. But the communion of saints is more than that. And the superstition came from the reality. The superstition, I'm sure you're very familiar with, the idea that you can pray to saints and they can minister to you and that sort of thing. That's superstition. But there is a communion of saints that takes place from one age to another. The dead do in a way minister to us in that the spiritual gifts and graces God gave them in their time, we stand upon that, and they still minister to us. Anybody here ever read Charles Spurgeon? I do on a regular basis. I love the guy. He's dead. But God gave him gifts and graces, and those gifts and graces remain for the church. It is the same in every age, both the names we know and also the names we don't know. We are present and belong to Jesus Christ because one age has passed the gospel to the next. They have been diligent to do that. We stand on every age where every age of Christ's people have ministered to us. And we minister this very day to people we do not know. If the Lord tarries, there will be generation after generation after generation, and they will stand on our faithfulness. we will have ministered to them. And Peter is very conscious of that call to ministry. He says, my life is fleeting while there is day. I am going to minister so that you will always remember these things. And what are these things? Well, we're working our way through this chapter. You already know it, but I'll just run over in a summary. It really breaks down into a nice three-point sermon. Faith is given by God. You have been given faith. Number two, every good thing for life and godliness comes through knowing Jesus Christ and the promises he has given. And number three, you are called to discipleship to add to your person these virtues so that in knowing Christ, you will actually produce the fruits that he wants in your life. Peter says he is reminding them of it. It's a basic summary, really basic, I mean very broad, but it is a summary of the gospel and the call to discipleship. And he turns around and he says, now, you already know this. In fact, you're absolutely well established in it. But I'm going to remind you of it anyway. Why would he do that? If they already know it and are established in it, why remind them? It's kind of the preacher's dilemma. After all, the gospel is fairly straightforward, and the Christian knows it. The Christian is established in the gospel, and yet the Bible time and time again repeats the gospel, calling the minister to repeat the gospel because we are to be men of the word. Well, why remind and remind and remind? I am reminded of the birds of the air that come and pick up the seed that is thrown along the ground in the parable of the sower. The birds represent satanic and dark influences that are always there wanting to pluck away the good things in our lives. I'm reminded of the evangelist who said, Madame, I don't know about you, but I leak. Human beings leak. We know and are established in the gospel, and yet there is a kingdom of darkness that would put us to sleep, lull us into forgetting. We have to be reminded again and again of these most basic things, because it is this basic gospel that is the power of God. It is this basic gospel centered totally on Jesus Christ that we draw our joy from, we draw our life from. There is an old hymn called I Love to Tell the Story. The last line of that hymn reads as follows. I love to tell the story, for those who know it best seem hungering and thirsting to hear it like the rest. That is certainly the way Christians ought to be. I remember being at a ministry some 8 years ago. One of the counselors there was complaining that he found the song a lie. He said, that's not true. The Christians that I know don't want to be reminded of the basics. They want the new and the novel thing. And sadly, I must agree with him. I have found that often. But our spiritual life is in constantly being reminded that God has been gracious in giving us faith. And every good thing we should ever hope to have comes from knowing Jesus Christ of Nazareth and what God the Father has done in him. His promises, of which we are very familiar, are the stuff of our lives. Peter is feeding God's sheep, feeding his lamb, by reminding them again and again and again that the Christian faith is not found in the next new novel thing. The Christian faith is not a matter of the next fad. The Christian faith is always about Jesus Christ and what God has done in him. and he is working for the glory of God, specifically not because God has promised him every joy, specifically not because God has promised him health, wealth, and prosperity, significantly not that God has not even promised him any sort of dignity, but has told him you will be humiliated in this world. He is laboring for the glory of God, knowing that the chief end of man is to glorify God and to enjoy Him forever. This is an example worth following. This is a life worth living. It should be noted, by the way, that although Peter went to a humiliating death, he watched his wife be murdered. 2,000 years later, the man who had him murdered, named Nero, only finds his name given to dogs. You would never give your son the name Nero. But we do name our sons Peter, and we'll do so as long as the Lord tarries.